fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call if you want to talk to me. 1-888-914-9149. It's toll free. The call's on me. It's coming out of my salary. You might as well use it. And also, you can reach me on Twitter. You can tweet at me. You can follow me at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And we also have a show account as well, run by the dynamic Lucas Holt, producer, and Karen Moran as well. At Cale Clark Show is the show account. It's kind of dangerous. It's got my picture on the account, but it's not actually run by me. And I don't know. I could get into legal trouble with this. But anyways, we also have an email account too, cale@relevantradio.com. Now, I don't know if you guys are big fans of, you know, Broadway musicals. I like them. I dig musicals. And are you fans of the musical Hamilton? You know this one. Here's a little clip. Lin-Manuel Miranda and his blockbuster musical Hamilton, which is came out in 2015, and now it's, of course, streaming on Disney Plus. And based on a recommendation from our good friend Lucas Holt, who produces the show, Lucas and his wife Gina really dug this musical. They were just totally into it, and Lucas recommended it to me, so me and Trish finally got around to watching it a little while ago. Loved it, loved it. However, I only got to the intermission. My time, I don't know, man. I'm getting old. I'm so tired at the end of the day. I crash, and I couldn't finish it. It's kind of late.
Feel bad,
so,
Cale.
Oh, Karen,
don't feel bad, Cale.
Why not?
It was hard for me too.
Oh, really? Oh,
and you've seen it was in color.
Are you guys kidding me? Are you guys kidding me right now? Neither of you made it through
yet.
Oh,
yet.
There's just too many choices out there.
Now, I was
into it.
I needed
subtitles. I needed backstory. I need to go back and study my history. I'm ashamed.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Virginia, and I should know it better.
You should.
It is interesting, though.
Should be more patriotic, Karen. But
don't,
I'll tell you what.
Don't feel bad,
Cale. I'm a Canadian, and I know more about this. No, I'm only kidding. But I will say this.
That hurt.
Ooh, that's a shot. But having said that, no, I was actually really enjoying it. I was totally enjoying it. And I've been meaning to watch the second half. So I don't know what happens to Alexander Hamilton in the end, so don't blow it for me. But here's why I mentioned this today, because there's an article over at The Pillar written by Mary Farrow about the fact that, and a lot of people don't know this, a lot of Catholics don't know this, that Alexander Hamilton, not the guy from the Broadway show, but the actual founding father of the United States, Alexander Hamilton was actually really good friends with a canonized saint of the Catholic Church. And I'm going to ask you to guess who it is, the crew of the Cale Clark Show. And I'll give you one hint. I'll give you a couple hints. Number one, she's a lady. And number two, her nickname was Wild Betsy, which I think is an awesome nickname.
I have a guess, though, Cale. When you said Wild Betsy, I don't know if I have it, but can I give a guess?
You can make the guess. Yeah.
Elizabeth Ann Seton?
You got it. You got it. This is like Jeopardy. Yeah. For $500, Alex, I'll take Catholic Saints in America.
Patrick is our Jeopardy.
Patrick's our Jeopardy champion. So, yes, it was St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. And, of course, she is the first native-born American saint. Now, the Setons, now, I don't know if you know this, but Elizabeth Ann Seton, St. Elizabeth Seton, was, in fact, married, had a family, had children. A lot of people don't know that. But the Seton family is not actually in the musical Hamilton. However, in real life, the Setons and the Hamiltons were neighbors. They hung out with each other. They worshiped together at the same church. They would socialize. They ran in the same kind of circles. And they also actually worked on charitable projects together in the community. So this is really interesting. So this article on The Pillar interviews Catherine O'Donnell. Now, Catherine O'Donnell is a history professor at Arizona State University, and she actually wrote a biography of St. Elizabeth Seton. And the two families were actually really well matched to be friends. They had very similar levels of education. This is a case of birds of a feather flock together. Similar education levels, similar social status. They were also, both families were of Scottish descent. And you know what they say, if it's not Scottish, it's, you know what. So St. Elizabeth Seton's legacy by the way, as the first American native-born saint, is being showcased this year. I don't know if you've been to the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton in Emmitsburg, Maryland, but this is the 200th anniversary of her death, which would be, of course, her heavenly birthday. So there are lots of events, lots of things planned at the Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. So if you live in the area, or even if you don't, you might want to make a bit of a pilgrimage this year in 2021 as travel starts to kind of open up again and we all get vaccinated, hopefully at some point in the future, and we can move on with our lives. But let me just tell you a little bit about St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, if you don't know much about her. And I really didn't either, to be perfectly honest. So she's someone that I need to learn much more about. And I was happy to read this because it really fleshed out some things for me. So she was born in 1774 to a colonial family in New York. And her dad and her future, by the way, her actual maiden name was Bailey. Elizabeth Ann Bailey was her name. And her father, Mr. Bailey, and her future father-in-law, Mr. Seton, they were both supporters of the British, oddly enough, during the Revolutionary War. But afterwards, after everything, you know, went down the way it went down, they did become key players in building up the United States. Now, Elizabeth's father, his name was Dr. Richard Bailey. He was actually the health officer of New York City for a while. And that's how he kind of got to know Alexander Hamilton. St. Elizabeth Seton actually called Hamilton and another guy that was sort of running in these circles, the founding father, Governor Morris, men of superior sense and great brilliancy of wit. I don't know if the original Alexander Hamilton had witty raps like we see in the Broadway musical, but he was a very witty guy. He was a very witty guy. And actually, Dr. Bailey actually wrote a letter to his daughter Elizabeth and said this, and I quote, "I esteem it a high good fortune to be on a footing of communication of feeling and sentiment with these guys." So he was really taken with Alexander Hamilton. Oh, so Mr. Seton, her future father-in-law, he worked for the Bank of New York. The Bank of New York, which was founded by, guess who? Alexander Hamilton. Elizabeth's future husband, who is William Seton Jr., also worked at this bank, which was owned by or founded by Alexander Hamilton. So Elizabeth married William Seton in 1794, and they lived on a particular street, which is very famous to you. You would know it in New York City. It's called Wall Street. Yep. They lived on Wall Street, and that was really the stomping grounds, as Catherine O'Donnell explains, of Alexander Hamilton. In fact, Hamilton and his family lived on the same street. And so they got to know each other. The Setons and the Hamiltons both went to Trinity Church, which was an Episcopalian church on Wall Street. Now, the Episcopalian church, of course, is the what they call the Anglican church in the United States. So a lot of very prominent New York socialites attended that church as well at the time. And Elizabeth Seton and Eliza Hamilton, Alexander's wife, they actually probably bonded together because they were both way more religious than their husbands were. Alexander, his faith would kind of, you know, it'd be up and down throughout his life. He really respected religion, thought it was a pillar of society. He actually requested to receive communion on his deathbed. Of course, this would have been the Anglican form of communion, so not the body and blood of Christ, but he did desire communion. So Elizabeth Seton and Eliza Hamilton also connected a lot socially through charitable work. They worked on behalf of widows and single mothers. And what's kind of interesting about this is that both of them did become widows eventually. And I just mentioned that I have not seen the end of the play Hamilton, but I think I may have just given away the ending to myself about what happens to Alexander.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Anyways, Elizabeth Ann Seton and Eliza Hamilton were women of privilege, but they also were very vulnerable people. They came to see vulnerability, to try to help those who were vulnerable, and they themselves became vulnerable as widows and single moms as well. So they did create this organization to help other women. And in fact, there was an orphanage that was later founded in Alexander Hamilton's honor. And it's still out there today. It's called it's called Graham Wyndham. Graham Wyndham. It's not what it was called back in the day, but it still exists today, this orphanage. So I mentioned that they both became widows, the wife of Alexander Hamilton and and Elizabeth Ann Seton. And the untimely death of their husbands was very obviously difficult for them to deal with, but this indirectly led to Elizabeth embracing Catholicism. And here's how it happened. So William Seton was very, very sick with tuberculosis. And in 1803, Elizabeth, William, and their oldest daughter, whose name was Anna Maria, they went to Italy. And really what they were trying to do was, in a sense, seek out experimental treatment for tuberculosis, which was obviously very deadly at the time. And they went to Italy, and they had to quarantine, very much like modern days. They quarantined for 2 weeks, but unfortunately, 2 weeks after that, William died. And he obviously the treatment was not successful, and he died in Italy. So at that point, Elizabeth Seton was 29 years old. She was bankrupt. She became bankrupt, and she was a single mother to five children. Now, these Italian friends that they had, they wasted no time trying to convert Elizabeth to Catholicism after the death of her husband. And they tried to comfort her, obviously, but she actually wrote about this apparently in her diary, Elizabeth Seton. She said there's some line in her diary where she says, "Oh, these charitable Romans, they're not going to let a minute go by without trying to convert me." And and she had become more interested in religion herself in the days, you know, before her husband took ill. In fact, there was a new pastor that came to this Episcopalian church, Trinity Church, that the Hamiltons went to and that Elizabeth Ann Seton went to. And this charismatic preacher kind of got her interested a little bit more in her faith. He was a great preacher, very charismatic, as I said. So she became interested in the liturgy, and she started thinking about what does it mean to have a personal relationship with God, an experience of that. And so she made a bit of an inner shift from being somebody who just went to church because it was the good social thing to do. This is what quote-unquote good people did in society. They went to church on Sundays. And it became more of a passion for her. And so she started going to daily mass. Her Italian friends, as she's grieving the loss of her husband, started inviting her to go to daily mass. And she went. And Catherine O'Donnell, this religious scholar, this historian from Arizona State University, says, quote, "To her surprise, Elizabeth finds herself reacting not just as a tourist, but somebody who's actually moved by Catholicism. She's moved by the figure of the Virgin Mary, who is obviously much more important in Catholicism than in the kind of Protestantism that she had known. She loves the art of the Catholic Church. She loves the culture, the saints, the idea of the intercession of the saints, and she loves the Mass." Little could she know at this point that she herself would be a canonized saint one day and be in stained glass windows and statues would be made of her. But she didn't convert right away. In fact, she went back to New York in 1804 with her daughter. And there was a lot of pressure from her family to drop this idea of becoming Catholic. It's ridiculous. Obviously, in the America at that time, Catholicism was viewed with a high degree of suspicion. And in some quarters, it still is, of course. And before John F. Kennedy became president back in the 1960s, there was still a great deal of anti-Catholicism in the culture, and he faced that a lot in his presidential campaign. But here's what happens. She comes back to America, still thinking about the church. Her relatives are saying, no, don't do that. That's ridiculous. Within a month of her getting back to the U.S., Alexander Hamilton is shot and killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. So is there any point in me watching the rest of Hamilton? Of course there is. The music is great. The tunes are great.
Just to say stuff. You did it. Yeah.
But anyway, so now I know what happened to him. But that's okay. So the suspense is gone, but I can still enjoy the music. And Elizabeth actually heard about his death because bells were tolling throughout the streets of New York. Businesses were ordered to be closed for the day. And she recorded it in her diary as a quote-unquote melancholy event, the circumstances of which are really too bad to even think of. So anyway, she eventually does convert to Catholicism, obviously, in 1805, despite all of the efforts of her family and friends to keep her as an Anglican. And as for her family, Catherine O'Donnell, the scholar, says she thinks they're often unfairly portrayed as being anti-Catholic. Actually, what they really wanted her to do is to get married again. They wanted her to find and marry a rich Protestant guy, and fast. And they wanted they were looking out for her. They wanted her to be well taken care of. They were somewhat anti-Catholic in their outlook, but And really, they're like a lot of people in culture today. They were uncomfortable with the idea of evangelization, somebody trying to get somebody to convert to another faith. And so really, they're concerned about her financial well-being, the well-being of the children. But Seton, for her own, you know, in her own mind, Elizabeth Ann Seton, she ultimately became Catholic because she could not reason her way out of it. She couldn't reason her way out of it. And she almost looked at it like Pascal's wager. And this is interesting because I thought of this as I was reading the article. And then Catherine O'Donnell, the historian, actually says this. So it was kind of interesting. She said, quote, "It's almost like a version of Pascal's wager. The Catholics are kind of more terrifying with the consequences of getting this wrong. But she also feels this pull to Catholicism. And so she decides, whatever the consequences, she's going to convert." End of quote. So for those of you who are listening, you might not know what Pascal's wager is. Blaise Pascal, great thinker in the history of the church, a mathematician. One of the things that he said was, this is with respect to belief in God. If I say that there's a God, and you say there isn't a God, I say there is a God, and the consequences of rejecting God in this life are an eternity separated from him in hell. But if you accept God, if you follow him, you can achieve forgiveness of sins, everlasting life in heaven. Well, if you're wrong and I'm right, after we die, you lose and I get everything. However, if we're both wrong, really, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. If we're both wrong about God, then we're both, you know, in bad shape anyways. But if I'm right, I get everything. So the wager is, you might as well just, even if you weren't quite sure about it 100%, you might as well believe, because the consequences, if you're wrong, if you don't believe, are pretty bad. I don't know if I explained that well, but that could also be applied to the church in a sense. And I've always thought this, and I've said this to my Protestant friends, because a lot of them look at the Catholic Church as just another denomination, just the same as any other. Now, most these days, it's extremely rare. It used to be pretty common back in the old days, but it's pretty rare now to find anybody who will say that Catholics aren't real Christians. Most Protestants will admit, yes, they're real Christians. There's a lot of cooperation now between evangelicals and Catholics in the culture wars. So I say to these guys, these friends of mine who are evangelicals, and I was an evangelical for many years, so I know how they think. If you guys think that this is just another Christian denomination, then why not just join it? Because if it really is what it claims to be, if the Catholic Church really is the church founded by Jesus Christ that he wants all Christians to be a part of, and if you know that the Catholic Church is the church, now obviously they don't know this, otherwise they'd be Catholic, but if it's got all these gifts for you from Christ, and if it really is the true church, if you join it, well, and it turns out to be, which we think it is, then you gain everything. But if you don't, you kind of lose, right? I mean, you've got nothing to lose. If it's just another denomination, you've got nothing to lose by joining it. But if it is what it claims to be, then you've gained everything. You've gained so much more than what you had before. You've got the full meal deal of the Christian faith now. You've got the sacraments, the true body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist. You've got the teachings of the church. You've got the intercession of the saints. You've got the Mass. You've got confession, forgiveness of sins. You've got all this stuff that the Bible plus so much more. And so I've used a version of Pascal's wager to talk to my friends about this. And I don't know if I explained that well, but having said that.
Kale.
Yeah.
A question from Karen. Mm. What do you think the resistance is to that argument? In my mind, I think I don't understand what that means. You know, but it's okay to not understand it. It's a mystery, right? What do you think is the hesitation? I mean, it's a solid argument.
I think there are some hesitations. Obviously, when I ask my friends about this, you know, what would make you not? Why wouldn't you become Catholic? Obviously, the Virgin Mary comes up, the Marian teachings. A lot of guys and gals, they just don't get it. They just don't understand the emphasis on Mary. So that needs to be explained as well. To some extent, the Eucharist, the papacy. Now, the Eucharist is interesting because it's one doctrine that. It's rarely disbelieved on biblical grounds, but it's often disbelieved because it seems too good to be true. Like, if it really is true, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Christ is literally in the tabernacle down at the end of my street. Wow. I can actually receive him and be united with him. Wow. amazing. You know,
what for me is I've been a Catholic my whole life, and these mysteries keep revealing themselves to me. So it's not as if Catholics, well, I don't know. And from my Catholic point of view, the more I embrace it, the more it becomes real. So it's like, maybe that's what's so great about being born into the Catholic faith, is that it really does sort of get through to you over your lifetime. And maybe making the choice to jump in is a harder one. But my mother converted from Southern Baptist to Catholicism.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is kind of a big jump. But I think for her, it's the same thing. So maybe it was her newness, her discovery, her new eyes on the faith that helped me have that perspective. But I heard once a lovely religious sister say, before she converted, she would go to adoration, and she was not sure if that was Jesus. But she prayed, "If that is you, please help me to understand that it is you." And I think that's just so like natural. Like, we don't have to understand it all. It's a mystery. What it is, beautiful.
That's right, absolutely. And we can know that it's true, but we'll never get to the bottom of it.
Not have to know the facts about it. Right, yes.
Exactly. And that's when we Catholics talk about mysteries, we're not talking about an unsolvable puzzle like a Sherlock Holmes adventure. It's
just
simply a truth
unknowable.
That's so deep we'll never get to the bottom of it. And it makes sense. Okay. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. If you're on the phones, hold on. We'll be right back. We'll get to you.
This is the Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, we're back on the Cale Clark Show. Glad you're along with me. We've been talking about Hamilton, not the musical, but the actual founding father of the United States, Alexander Hamilton, who was great pals, really good friends with St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, who was his neighbor. She and her husband on Wall Street in New York City. And of course, I told the story before the break of how St. Elizabeth Ann Seton's husband passed away in Italy. That began a journey that she undertook of interest towards the Catholic Church. And obviously she converted when she came back to New York, even though her family wanted her to remarry to a rich Protestant businessman. She said no. And really, their worst fears came true because they had this idea that the Catholic Church was a place of crazy enthusiasts who keep women captive in convents. And really, that's exactly what she did. But she wasn't a captive. She was a captive to Christ, of course, but she made this choice on her own. And Elizabeth founded and led the Sisters of Charity, of course, an order which is dedicated to serving the poor through soup kitchens, hospitals, schools, orphanages, other ministries. And she did all of this while raising her children at the same time as a single mother. Incredible. Incredible. I guess you could say she was really a female CEO. And after years of service, she died at the age of 46, having contracted tuberculosis. And that was, in fact, the disease that killed her husband and also two of her children. And she was canonized in 1975, as I said, the first United States-born saint, and she is the co-patron of the United States. And in this article, and I encourage you guys to read this, we'll post it in the show notes. It's from the Pillar website. And this historian, Catherine O'Donnell, who was quoted a lot in this article about Seton and Hamilton, she became interested in the story of Elizabeth Ann Seton after a student submitted a project about her, and she really didn't know much about her before then. And Catherine O'Donnell says, on the one hand, she was a woman who ended up being a single and working mother, but she also succeeded in finding time to lead a life of faith also. And that's something that can be really inspiring to all of us because we're all busy. Most of us have demanding careers, families on the go. We can find time for God. We can make time for God. It has to be a priority. And she can encourage us in that regard too, so we can ask her to pray for us, to be sure. But what a great nickname, Wild Betsy. I think that's one of the best saint nicknames I've ever heard in my life. And once again, this year, if you want to check out, in Emmitsburg, Maryland, the shrine dedicated to Mother Seton, there's lots of events and exhibitions happening this year because it's the 200th anniversary of her passing, her heavenly birthday. We're going to go to the phones right now. Val is on the line from Chicago. Val, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a teenage daughter, so I know the Hamilton soundtrack by heart. but there's a beautiful song in there, and it's called It's Quiet Uptown, because the Hamiltons, after their rise in the political world and the creation of Wall Street and the National Bank, they were beset with their own personal tragedies, including the death of their son at a duel, which Alexander Hamilton didn't stop. So, you know, they're grieving, and his wife was obviously very disappointed. But the song Quiet Uptown talks about Hamilton saying, like, now he's in the quiet, and I take the children to church on Sunday, and there's a sign of the cross at the door, and I pray. And then later in the song, they talk about there's moments that words don't reach. There is a grace too powerful to name. And then the song crescendos into forgiveness. And it's just really a beautiful song. So I can see, like, Elizabeth Ann Seton's giving in Liza. I think in Hamilton, the story of Liza, his wife, is just amazing. And you know, she has decades of philanthropy and the orphanage you mentioned. But so thank you for bringing up the American history of our saints, because we don't know enough about them. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think that's what's cool. Now, you mentioned your teenage daughter knowing the soundtrack off by heart, and you're kind of forced to listen to it as well. And it's great stuff. I mean, it's not you're forced to. You like it too. But it's amazing that this musical has, in fact, inflamed this desire for the young to learn about American history and in such a fresh way. And as Lin-Manuel Miranda, who created this musical, says, It's America then told by America now. And I think that's a great way to put it. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm going to watch part two. I have to watch the rest of the play that happens after the intermission. And I already know what kind of happens to Alexander now in the end, but I still got to watch it. And I will. I promise. My wife and I will watch the end of it.
Yeah,
thanks for calling.
Otherwise your daughter will make you in about a decade. So
wait. Yep, that's true. Yep. Thank you so much, Val. Thanks very much for the call and for listening. That's Val calling from Chicago. And that song that she mentioned, It's Quiet Uptown. We may have a little clip for you from that song later on in the program, maybe going to our next break. So watch for that. But something else that was on my mind, another interesting piece that I came across that I think is so relevant for today, is there was a piece by a guy named David Bonaguirre Jr., who teaches at St. Joseph's Seminary in New York, and it was on the Catholic Thing website. It was about how to do apologetics in the age of cancelization. The age of cancellation. Cancelization isn't really a word, but cancellation is. So we're obviously dealing with this whole concept of cancel culture, which is all over the internet right now and social media. And he mentions this important book, and I actually have this book. It's on my shelf right now. I can actually see it from where I'm sitting right now as I do this radio show with you. In 2004, Cardinal Avery Dulles wrote a book called A History of Apologetics. And he's considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, American theologian of the 20th century. And in that book, he called for a rebirth of apologetics. And I remember that book so well, not just because apologetics is something that I'm totally fascinated with and interested in, and really helped me to come to faith in Jesus in general back when I was in university, and then the Catholic faith in particular later on. So important for me personally, but really for all of us. We need to know how to explain and defend our faith today. And you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. And this book, A History of Apologetics, was, I have very, very vivid memories of reading this book, because I actually got the book the year after it came out in 2005. That was the year I got married to Trish. And it was also the summer I nearly died. And I had just been reading that book right before I almost died. I was, just to set the stage for you, I'll just tell a quick sidebar story here. So my wife and I went to visit a friend of hers who her parents lived on Long Island. And so we went down there, this little summer trip. We spent a few days down there. We went to the beach on Long Island. Now, I can't swim, despite the fact that I grew up about 5 minutes from the Atlantic Ocean in Nova Scotia. I never really learned how to swim properly. And I have since learned a little bit. I can kind of dog paddle a little bit. But still, I'm not going to challenge Michael Phelps for any Olympic medals or anything like that. But at this point, 2005, I still could not swim at all. So I decided to kind of wade out into the water a little bit. The tide was going out. I went a little bit too far on the beach in Long Island. And I'd just been reading this book, A History of Apologetics, on the beach. It was pages were full of sand. I said, I'm going to take a little dip here. I went out too far. I very nearly got swept away by the current. I remember just losing contact with the ground. I was spinning around under the water. And I almost died that day. It was really, really close. So that book, I'll never forget that book for many reasons. But in the book, Cardinal Dulles, in this history of apologetics, he talks about the fact that apologetics today, defending and explaining the faith today, should really focus on the personal testimony or the personal witness, as it's called, of the apologist, of the one who's proposing the Catholic faith, the witness of the person over the content of the arguments. It's more important in this day and age, the witness of the person, not what you're actually saying. Now, what you're saying is obviously important too, but this really harkens back to something that Pope Paul VI said so many years ago when he said that the modern world listens to witnesses more than they will listen to teachers. And if they do listen to teachers, it's because they're witnesses. So this personal lived out testimony is that's what people are going to find credible or not credible when it comes to the faith. And so in this article, David Bonagura Jr., who teaches at St. Joseph's Seminary, he says that when we focus on the aspirations of the human heart for communion with the divine, because whether we know it or not, our hearts are looking for God. Again, that dictum of St. Augustine comes to mind. Our hearts are restless until they rest in you, Lord. If we realize that this is what people are looking for in their heart, they have this longing for God, they try to fill it with so many other things. If we understand the personal approach, we can really reach people, because most people in today's culture, they're suffering from two things. He calls it the anonymity of contemporary collectivism or the isolation of contemporary individualism. I think the isolation part we can all understand, and most of us have been isolated more than we would like to be, especially during the time of the pandemic. But what he talks about, the anonymous contemporary collectivism, this is the anonymous crowd. This is the anonymous nature of, say, online community. A lot of what passes for social interaction today leaves people wanting in this area. I think we'll all agree on that. But we can't discount the fact that the internet has offered a way for us to do apologetics, to share our faith, that even back in 2004, Cardinal Dulles probably didn't realize how big this was going to be. So how do we focus this in the internet age? How can we do personal evangelism and sharing our faith in the age of the internet? That's a great question. That's a really good question. So what this guy, David Bonagura, says is that apologetics can only succeed online if there's trust between the apologist and the questioner, the person who's interested in Catholicism. Because that person is only going to accept the testimony of the Catholic when they trust that guy as a person or that lady as a person. And this is why very often today when people come into the church, they will say, it's because of a specific person. So, for example, somebody might say, Patrick Madrid from Relevant Radio was a huge factor in me becoming Catholic because I called into his radio show one day. I just wanted to argue with him. I didn't like what he was saying about the church. Didn't agree with him. But he started talking to me, and he started to interact with me. I started reading his books, and I started to be persuaded of the truth of the Catholic position. So Patrick Madrid has made a huge difference in my life. So that happens all the time in this day and age. By contrast, if somebody rejects the Catholic message, very often, it's not because they're rejecting the message itself, it's because they're rejecting the witness who's preaching it to them. So, for example, if somebody is exposed as a fraud or somebody who commits a great sin, is a cause of a scandal, we've had lots of scandals, obviously, in the church recently, that is not exactly a motive of credibility for people to believe. That can really hurt people in their attempt to seek the truth. And what this article then goes on to talk about is this idea of cancel culture. Because within the last few years, the dark side of the internet, even within the church, there's been this sort of fractioning of groups. And if you don't believe me, hang out on Catholic Twitter for a while. There are radical traditionalists. There are who don't want to talk to anybody who supports Pope Francis, that sort of thing. There's all these sort of wars within the church on Twitter. And if anybody dares to tell somebody, oh, I think you're wrong about this, they get often canceled or all kinds of abuses heaped upon them. And this happens all the time. So in this article, David Bonagura says very often before someone will press play on a sound clip or video from somebody who's Catholic, the person's going to want to know, oh, what tribe do they belong to? What type of Catholic are they? If they, for example, wrote an article for the wrong Catholic website, which I don't like, or if they appeared on this radio show, oh, I don't like that network, I don't even want to listen to this guy. I'm going to dismiss this out of hand. And so this makes it really, really hard to bridge that gap. And some people don't even want to engage in apologetics online because they're afraid of this. They're afraid of being canceled. They're afraid of saying something and being attacked. And for a lot of people, they just say, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. So what this guy proposes is we've got to recapture the faith of the martyrs. And sometimes in our culture, in our civilization, now there's actual red martyrdom going on all around the world. Of course, there are more Catholics martyred in the last 200 years than in the whole history of the church combined. It happens all the time. It's happening all around. Look at what's going on right now in places like Nigeria. Priests being kidnapped, all kinds of atrocities being committed overseas. So there are actual martyrs, but there are also people who have lost their reputation. They have lost their jobs in a lot of cases because of their Catholic faith. They've been persecuted by the online mob, if you will. So how should you proceed in this environment? Well, what's interesting about the martyrs, when we look at church history and look at people who have given their life for the gospel, they always say that the death of the martyrs is the highest form of apologetics. It's the greatest way to defend the faith, to die for it. And it's kind of ironic, as David Bonagura says, because in human terms, they failed. The fact that they did get killed, they were murdered, that shows us that their apologetic enterprise didn't work, at least at a human level. People don't trust them, so they get rid of them. However, when they do die, other people start to believe. We all know the saying, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So what he's suggesting is that we might need a few internet martyrs here. We might need a few people who are willing to take the risk of putting themselves out there, preaching the truth, preaching the faith. They might get, quote unquote, killed for this online in terms of reputation, whatever. They might get canceled for being Catholic. And no one will ever know they're suffering. They're not going to be, no one will know. It's not like a public martyrdom. No one will ever know, maybe except for them, what they've given up, what they've lost, but it's still worth it. It's still worth it. And we've got to make it personal. When you connect with somebody online, just one last thing, when you connect with somebody online, the greatest guys out there try to personally connect with their audience, maybe email them or follow up with them. So they actually have a real relationship. It's not just a one-way conversation. That's tough to do online, but I found that just to be a really interesting piece on how to do apologetics in the cancel culture of the internet today. I don't know if that resonates with you. If it does, give me a call. We can talk about it. 1-888-914-9149's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We'll be back, and I can't wait to share with you what I've got next after the break. Steve Jobs would not be happy with how you're using your phone. I'll tell you why right after this. Forgiveness. Can you imagine if you see him in the street, walking by your side, talking by your side, have pity. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Glad you're with me. You know, something I wanted to talk about last week, but we only have an hour every day, so I just ran out of time. I wanted to talk about the birthday of Steve Jobs, who, of course, founded Apple Computer along with Steve Wozniak in a garage in California. It's just a great story. Now, he was born on February the 24th, 1955. He would have been 66 in 2021. And obviously, his death was in some ways needless because if he had just gotten proper medical treatment for his cancer, in all likelihood, he still would be with us today. But an interesting thing to think about when it comes to Steve Jobs, technology, the way we all use our smartphones, our devices, is that he probably never would have wanted us to use our iPhones. And I'm going to expand this, of course, to any device, whether it be an Android, whatever. He would never have wanted us to use our smartphones the way we do. And Cal Newport, and he writes a lot for the New York Times and other outlets, computer science professor at Georgetown University and author. He's got a new book coming out today, actually. It's called A World Without Email. A lot of people want to go with Elon Musk on a mission to Mars. I want to go to a world without email. That sounds pretty awesome. But anyways, he wrote this piece for the New York Times a while back on Steve Jobs and his original vision for the iPhone and for using a smartphone. It's so different. It's well worth it. If you have the time, and it's worth it on a lot of levels, if you go on the internet, if you go on YouTube, you can watch the original keynote presentation that Steve Jobs gave. And if you do present for a living, if you do any kind of public speaking or presenting, it's well worth watching the craft of Steve Jobs because he was so great at this. Just amazing. His PowerPoints, he didn't kill people with bullets. Bullets kill, he used to say. It'd be like one line on his PowerPoint slides. Amazing. Anyways, I'm off track a little bit. But it's well worth going on YouTube and watching the way he presents in 2007 at the Moscone Convention Center in San Francisco when he introduced the world to the iPhone. Here was the big reveal when he revealed it to the world. People didn't know this was coming.
Today, we're introducing three revolutionary products of this class. The first one is a widescreen iPod with touch controls. The second is a revolutionary mobile phone. And the third is a breakthrough internet communications device. So, three things: a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. An iPod, a phone, and an internet communicator. An iPod. A phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
All right. That was an incredible introduction. The way he did that was so cool. Are you getting it? These are not three different products. What's kind of funny listening to this, you know, so many years later, when he mentioned internet communication device, there was like very lukewarm applause, you know. Everyone kind of went crazy for it. It's a phone. And it's interesting. I mean, that's how they conceived of it at the time. It was really, and Apple engineers talk about this to this day, he didn't have any kind of vision back then for the App Store. In fact, Steve Jobs didn't want there to be an App Store in the beginning because he didn't trust third-party developers to offer the same kind of pleasing and stable experiences that Apple programmers could produce. So really, when the iPhone first shipped, there was only a few different apps on it. It was basically an iPod that made phone calls. It was a really nice iPod with a really nice screen at the time that made phone calls. And he really didn't think it was going to be this super Swiss Army knife of devices that could do literally everything with all the apps that you can put on it. He thought it would help people with really a tiny number of activities: listening to music, making phone calls. He talked a lot about Google Maps, getting directions. But really, when you watch the whole keynote, he doesn't talk about even really using the internet on the phone for 30 minutes into the presentation. So Cal Newport says he wasn't really trying to radically change the way we live our daily lives. He wanted simply to take the experiences that we already find important and make them better. He wants it to be a useful tool that's going to enhance our life. He doesn't want it to become our life. And I've seen cartoons where, you know, on one panel, a guy is holding his smartphone, and in the next panel, the smartphone is holding the guy. I mean, it's controlling their life. And sometimes that's what's happening to us. So instead of being a constant companion, and I remember Samsung once advertised its Galaxy smartphone as just that, a quote-unquote life companion. Instead of being something that was with you all the time, ubiquitous, in your face at all hours, it was originally meant, the original iPhone was simply meant to improve activities that you already found important in your life before this technology existed, just to make life a little bit easier, not to replace so many other things that we were doing and enjoying. And so, really, I think if Steve Jobs were alive today, and this is what Cal Newport says, I agree with him, that he would be a minimalist smartphone user. So what does that mean, to be a minimalist smartphone user? Well, it means that you only use your device for a small number of things that you do that you value and that the device does really well. And then outside of these activities, you don't use it. You put it away. And that kind of dethrones the gadget from this position of constant companion that's always in front of you, it's always in your hand, to being like, and I like this analogy that Newport uses, really what it should be is more like a luxury object, like having a really nice bike or a high-end blender or maybe a really nice espresso machine. You really enjoy it when you're using it. It gives you great pleasure. It's a wonderful object, but it doesn't dominate your entire day. I mean, you're not hanging out with your espresso machine all day and playing with the buttons and knobs and pipes. No. So what he suggests to do, Newport, is to remove from your smartphone, if you want to lessen its grip on you, take off any apps that make money from your attention without giving you anything. So just always remember, folks, by the way, whenever something is free, oh, sign up for Facebook, it's free. Well, it's not free. Because you, in fact, are the product. Someone is making money here, and it's not you. You're actually the product. They're getting data from you. Now, I realize that we have to kind of balance this with the opportunities to use social media to evangelize. Although maybe we don't. Maybe we don't. Stephanie Gray Connors, who was on the show last week, she's left Facebook, and she has tons of opportunity to evangelize. She can't keep up with all the requests to speak and to write and things like that. And she's not even on social media. So maybe we don't need it to evangelize. I don't know. It's just something to think about. But there are obviously all kinds of apps, social media apps, addictive games, news feeds, clutter your screen with breaking notifications. Unless you're a cable news producer, you probably don't need minute-by-minute updates on world events. And your friends can probably handle it if you wait a few hours. Maybe at the end of the day, you can check in with them on Facebook or something. Anyways, I think one of the best things I've ever done, I disabled notifications on my phone. So it doesn't beep. I don't get the notification badge when I get a new email message or when I get a new text. So I use it. I make it work for me. It's not for other people's convenience. It's for my convenience. And it just has helped me to keep focused attention on my work and things like that throughout the day. Anyway, something to think about. Thanks for joining me today on The Cale Clark Show. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back tomorrow. Tim Murray is up next. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alok screened the calls. And Karen Moran worked social media and joined me for a fun conversation about Hamilton. And I got to watch the second half of Hamilton tonight for sure. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.